case was about in 2010, 2011. And I didn't even know I was suffering from anxiety attack. Ajahn Brahmali vouched, I gave him a call and asked him if I was becoming psychic. And he said, no, I don't think so. So I actually went to a doctor and had that diagnosed. I also had palpitation and I thought I was going to die of a heart attack. And I had breathing difficulty and I went for chest x-ray because I thought I was probably having cancer. So I just never thought that I was the one who would be suffering from depression. But the wonderful blessing was that I had all the pearls of wisdom that came from Ajahn Brahm and many other Dharma teachers that were like vitamins that had strengthened me, and of course mindfulness to put my mind back into balance. Because depression is really an illness of your mind going out of balance, just being so drawn to the past or just caught up with the future that looks hopeless. So in any case, we're going to be moving to a much more positive session, I would say, and hopefully my dress would help to brighten up the stage. And this is about positive Buddhist journeys. And we have an actress, an author, an educator, a monk. And he's not sitting there because he's male, but because he's the odd one out. So just want to make sure no one takes offense to why is the man getting the middle seat. That's just to keep the whole stage balanced because we didn't want it lopsided. So the first speaker is an actress who some of you may recognize from the movie 7 Years in Tibet. And she starred next to Brad Pitt as the wife of the Austrian mountaineer Peter Aufschneider. So she starred in another French-made American distributed Nepali adventure movie called Himalaya in 1999, where she was also one of the leading characters. So please join me to welcome a Hollywood actress, Lakpa Samcho.
Good morning, everybody. Hello? Can you hear me? Okay. I just acted in only 2 movies. First of all, I would like to say thanks to Ajahn Brahm, Cecilia, and their searching, and the organizers and the, for the conference. Thank you so much. I feel very honored and to get this opportunity here. Feeling after a long time, I'm coming back to a stage, and then I'm just feeling a little bit, you know, the heart is beating. Yeah, and I'm not good in, or should I say, I cannot tell jokes like Ajahn Brahm and make you laugh, or like speak in a million miles like Venerable Robina. I love Australian people from before, but I never thought in one day I'll be here. So I'm very happy to be here in Perth. This is the there's only one continent left that I've not seen. It's Africa, and I think it's okay if I don't get to see. I'm a little bit scared of Ebola and, you know, the girls getting abducted, and so I think it's okay. I was born in a Tibetan refugee settlement, and my parents came from Tibet. China attacked Tibet in 1959, and we lost our country, and His Holiness Dalai Lama left Tibet, and then after that, about 100,000 Tibetans fled Tibet, and now a lot of refugees in India, and many Tibetans are all over the world, actually. I must say that I feel I feel it's such a good karma to be born a Buddhist in the time of His Holiness Dalai Lama. Can I just show a photo of the Dalai Lama? the slide. Yes. I feel the world is very, Tibetans and the world have a great compassionate being. He's my hero, and I feel grateful to receive so many teachings from the Dalai Lama. And you guys here are very lucky and good karma to have Ajahn Brahm. I'm going to give you an example of my father. Whenever something bad happens, example, my father had an accident when I was very young, and he broke his leg into three pieces, and he was in a hospital for 6 months, and my mother was there taking care of him all the time. And then he was saying, he never blamed, why me? And he said, it's because of his karma, and he accepted. And so the healing was more easier, or it's more easier to, it's more easier to live, or so the Buddhist thought, it's built in. My parents, even though I'm born Buddhist, when we grew up, we didn't know that much intellectual philosophy of the Buddhism, and we didn't know how we didn't do meditation, and only going abroad in the West, I started to do really learn more about it, and then do some meditation and things like that. My parents are and other Tibetans, older generation, they are very, they have great faith, and they recite the prayers and the mantras, and they do all that, but not knowing the so much meaning, so much devotion. When I see His Holiness Dalai Lama, you feel so, there's eyes in my tears, and so much devotion and faith in him. He practiced what he preached, and you feel so inspired to be like him. And I'm going in a different order. The topic is not I'm just what's coming into my head. I'm just going through. Okay. Okay, so now jumping, after my college, I had the great opportunity to play the lead role in 7 years in Tibet. I'll show the next slide here. Okay. This is one of the 7 years in Tibet's the tailor scene. This is the place where the best thing that I did in life was in Sikkim, after the two movies that I acted, I got the opportunity to do a 3-year retreat in Sikkim, and this is the place. Very pleasant. This is just somebody took this photo. I thought it's nice to show you. This is the group retreat photo. The one in 7 years in Tibet. This is one of my favorite photo. Of the second movie called Himalaya. Lucky to be acting in that movie also. It was such a great experience. It was 9 months, and there was a break in between, in the winter break. The first time it like what the makeup lady, she said that she worked in so many films in Paris, and for like this movie, it was so difficult to make that the French crew, half of them did not return to Nepal because it's in the Himalayas and very cold and like out of the comfort zone. So I survived there for 9 months trekking. I've done all my trekking in life in that movie, actually. If you... This is one of the retreat photos. It's all in a different order. This is the retreat building. For the three-year retreat, I cut my hair. Like, so this hair is a little bit grown here. I also did a little bit of modeling. So there it is. I thought I should show you a place where this is a place where it's a lake where I grew up. I was swimming there and when I was young. I thought it's important to show Tibet, the mountains and the prayer flag. The modeling it was in New York. Back to my place where I'm living with my parents. They are old. My mother's like 82 and my dad is like 80. And so it's like considered very good karma to help when they need, to be in hospital, then I go and help and stay in the hospital during the knee operation and the recovery. So it's considered very good karma. And this is the place in South India where I'm living nearby to do koras. I thought I'd better show a photo of Brad Pitt. Okay, I think that's one more here. This is the Himalaya. He acted as my son. He looks like me, actually. A photograph from Tibet. This is the Himalaya photo. The Potala, it's in Tibet. One of the modeling photos. Okay. I think that's it. Just try to get some. That's the photos that I have. Okay, I have time, right? Okay, 5 minutes, okay. Oh, yes, I must say this. The three-year retreat, I think it's very, after doing the three-year retreat, before doing the three-year retreat, I did like Vipassana 10-day retreat by Goenka, and then 30-day retreat in U.S., and then later I went to do the three-year retreat in Sikkim, and I think very good experience, and the experience, like example, like your mind is more calm and positive, and your thoughts are much more positive, and so I encourage you to do like meditation, whichever you like. I think it's good to do it in a group. Like for me, the group practice was more supportive and better. When I go by myself, and it's more hard when you are alone and practice by yourself. So I think it's very good to do some whichever group meditation that's going on nearby you. But just make sure that. Just analyze the teacher and make sure, and just don't go and join there, because this teacher is like high and sometimes these problems, like you hear some so nowadays, like just because they're high lamas and very famous and people go there and then there's some problems, like, you know what I mean? Yeah, I also wanted to say, life in U.S., it was very busy, and I feel like when the plane lands in New York, you know, just before touching, you feel like some unease. Even though there is all the, you have so much food, nice house, you have the education belt, and you still want to acquire more, and this kind of cycle ends in like dissatisfaction. So what I mean to say is, so I believe, and also it's most important to tap into your own inner self and know the true reality of self, and that is the only way to bring the real peace within. So, like, I think I should share this one. When I was about 15 years old, I almost... Oh, okay. 1 minute left. Quickly here. When I was 15, I almost got raped by one of the person that I know where I grew up. Like, I grew up in a camp number 2 in Balakupe. It's like 100 families, and one of the members, like, he was much older. And so the first reaction was I got very angry and I wanted to take a revenge. But as I grew up and the Buddhist philosophy helped me, and I already forgive him, and recently, about 2 months back, I went and spoke to him, and I don't have any bad feelings now. You know, all the technologies, gadgets, high-tech thing, I'm not good in any of those. No matter how advanced you are in whatever the thing, but if you do not develop your heart and tame the mind, then all these external modern things may just give you a temporary happiness, but not real peace within. Okay. Yes, time's up. Let's see. Anything left? Okay. Oh, my. Okay, I think that's it. Time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, Lakpa. Thank you for that very natural way of presenting. And so those of you who present at conferences or seminars, and if your slides go into a shuffle mode, don't sweat it. Just remember how Lakpa handled it. Just take it as it comes. So let's have another round of applause for Lakpa. So next we have Sarah, who's an author of the Buddhism for Mothers series, which is published by Allen and Unwin, which has been translated into 9 languages to date. She has recently completed a graduate diploma in psychology from Macquarie University, as well as her most recent book, Buddhism for Couples, about applying Buddhist teachings in long-term relationship, is another one of her accomplishments. Practicing in the Western Insight tradition, Sarah strives to apply Buddhist teachings to her role as a mother, a wife, and a friend. She believes relationships in all their complexities, messiness, joy, and volatility make excellent ground for spiritual practice. Please join me to welcome Sarah.
Okay, microphone working? Everyone can hear me? Yes, good. Okay. As my talk here today has approached, I gradually formulated an aim that I want to give a talk that's honest and authentic. This is only because my first impulse was to try and trick you. So I'll start with a confession. I have occasionally over the last few weeks caught myself in a bit of a slump,
not an extended one, but you know how slumps come and go. Those slumps we all have from time to time where we feel a bit overwhelmed by stress, by family wrangling, by office politics. They may last a few hours, or maybe you're just having a bad day. So while I was in one of these slumps, I found myself thinking, geez, I'd better get myself together, or else I'm going to stand up in front of that audience and be a total fraud who has to lie about how great my life is due to Buddhist teachings. Followed by thoughts that went like this: what kind of Buddhist am I when my husband and I are so disgruntled with each other that we're not even talking to each other today? Or what kind of Buddhist am I when I'm on my third revenge fantasy about that certain person at work? And what kind of Buddhist am I when I've just yelled hysterically at my naughty son? So I thought to myself, oh no, I'll have to stand in front of a microphone and pretend that I deserve to be there, that I'm habitually calm and loving and at peace and full of joy when I'm actually in a bit of a slump. Fortunately, a wiser voice got involved in the conversation. Sarah, what makes you think that feeling out of sorts is un-Buddhist? Why can't a Buddhist experience some self-pity? Why should practicing Buddhism mean suppressing normal emotions or faking to the world that you're super nice all the time? I think it's a common pitfall of practice to expect ourselves to be calm all the time, to think we need to chop off the parts of ourselves that we don't want to own. But when you look at what the practice really requires of us, that approach is not Buddhism at all. On the contrary, the Buddhist path requires us to be there and not run away from our moments of suffering. If anger arises, we don't suppress it or ignore it or drink or distract ourselves. We make space for it. We remind ourselves that it's just a temporary, impermanent visitor. We examine the body sensations that go with anger, the thoughts that fuel it, the effects of anger. And by being there for it, with non-judgmental awareness, we're in a position to manage our anger so that we don't do anything too stupid with it. Sometimes being aware of our anger is enough to make it go. Sometimes not. Either way, it will go or transform with time, as it always does. I have come to the belief, after roughly 17 years of practice, that being a Buddhist is not about being calm and loving 24/7, or conforming to some stereotype of how a proper Buddhist should behave. I see practice as more about emotional honesty and authenticity, about asking myself, what am I really thinking? What am I really feeling? And what's truly going on here? Mind you, I did spend a few years worried that somebody somewhere might recognise me as a fraud. Especially having written some books on Buddhism, I felt a huge obligation to walk the talk. This led to feelings of great shame when I fell short. I'd written some books, a series of books, Buddhism for Mothers, so I'd find myself asking, oh, what would readers think if they could see me losing my temper at my boundary-pushing young son? Even though I admitted to this in the book, I still managed to feel great shame when I drifted too far from the Buddhist stereotype in my head. Eventually, I conceded, shame and guilt are such cliché reactions to stuffing up. But most importantly, shame and guilt don't make us change a thing. The things we feel ashamed and guilty about tend to be the things that we keep doing. A far more Buddhist reaction to slumps and funks and lows is to be curious, to be there for it, and to be self-compassionate. As part of giving an authentic and honest talk, I should probably say that I do see myself as quite neurotic, or at least quite an emotional person. We're all born with a certain temperament, and I believe my own temperament is a little prone to self-pity, a little prone to irritability and impatience, and especially prone to self-doubt. I probably do have to own up to having a short fuse, and I do find it very difficult to love everyone. Not that being neurotic necessarily makes me special or gives me a self to attach to. It's not a fixed state. Often enough, I can be quite together. The late Jocko Beck, the Zen teacher from the States, said, and I love this quote, The profile of the average American Zen student is that of a tertiary educated, intelligent and caring, middle class neurotic. I think that probably captures a lot of us gathered here today. One reason I wanted to share with you about my neurotic tendencies was as a community service. A Buddhist practice can be potentially hard on your self-esteem. Many, many people leave Buddhism feeling a sense of failure, such as in, I just can't meditate, I could never control my mind. Or people, once they finally practice mindfulness of their own thinking, feel so disgusted with themselves that they can't bear it anymore and prefer the path of distraction from dukkha. A favourite author of mine called Sam Harris, he's a towering intellectual who'd I'd always have imagined to have very highbrow, worthy thoughts. This is what he said about mindfulness of thinking. Listening to the voice in, he's American too. Listening to the voice in my head is like being kidnapped by the most boring person alive, who just goes on and on with the same old stuff, most of it negative, all of it self-referential. If you articulated this stuff, people would think you were crazy, but we seem to just accept it as normal and actually take it seriously. So I'll tell you a little bit about my path into Buddhism. When I was 24, I was teaching English in Jakarta, Indonesia, and grappling with culture shock and wondering why I was such an irritable person. I chanced on a book called The Heart of Buddhism by Guy Claxton, which challenged all my assumptions about how to be happy. It emphasised our over-reliance on external conditions. It emphasised the way we believe our thoughts about what we need to make us happy and how our unhappiness is largely self-inflicted and how suffering can be traced back to our false belief in the self. So throughout my 20s, Buddhism was something I dabbled in as I continued to read this book, The Heart of Buddhism, once every year or two. There was no internet, so I was not aware of any groups that I could join, so this book was all I had to sustain me. And my practice without the support of Sangha or even other books was very sporadic and by no means central to my life. But every time I read this book, I was reminded of another way to be. When I was around 30 and pregnant, I worried that I might get postnatal depression. And I didn't. I was lucky, and I owe a lot of that to Buddhist teachings, I think, and genetics and all the other things that go into depression. But I also wanted to I also wanted a means to keep myself sensible and sane and ethical and strong enough to be a good mother. I knew I had some neurotic tendencies and I'd done some very stupid things in my 20s. So I started to take Buddhist practice much more seriously. By that time, I was becoming aware of Buddhist groups and Buddhist books and the internet, and so my practice had some supports. Motherhood presented me with all kinds of challenges, and my Buddhist practice helped me to meet them. Most of all, I feel my practice was a reminder to be present and attentive to my children. When they spoke, I would be more likely to stop, sometimes even kneel down and look into their face and give them my full attention. Rather than obsessing over a to-do list, as is always the temptation, and ignoring them, my practice challenged me to make being present with them the priority. This enabled me to enjoy them, to engage in moments of joy and playfulness, to connect deeply with them. During times of difficulty, such as their tantrums or my boredom or illness or marital conflict, I could practice mindfulness of my thoughts. This meant that I didn't buy into my thoughts so much. They didn't push me around so much and make me do stupid things. Mindfulness provided a safe container for them, which helped me to be less reactive and generally guarded my mental health. My children are now 17 and 13, and about 18 months ago, I stopped working from home as a writer and started working full-time in a very high-pressure job as a child protection caseworker. A collective intake of breath. I can't tell you how intense this job is. There's never any downtime. The office politics, being the public service, can be fierce. The families I work with can also be a real challenge. In the last few months, one of them took her complaints about me to my manager in a letter. Another took their complaints about me to their local member in a letter. and another to the ombudsman. So the work can be very button pressing, but I'm just perverse enough to find it all quite interesting. The new job has been a major lifestyle change from being a writer at home, and it's really confronted me in my practice, which remains a strong support. In my first year in the job, there were months where I just meditated at the weekend because I was too time-poor to do anything else, I told myself. But I soon realised that I was not being very mindful in the workplace, and my mind became consumed with dramas and office politics and anger with various individuals. Eventually, I had a blinding flash of the obvious, where I knew I had to start each day with a meditation sit before work. So I squeezed that in after the kids left for school. Being the public service, there's a little bit of flexibility about time of arrival at work, thankfully. Meditating in the morning made a huge difference as it helped me to reconnect with stillness and presence at various points throughout the day, rather than being swept away by the drama and the stress and my own reactivity. I kept that up for 3 solid months, daily sitting, but then we had a week of violent rain and I had to drive the kids to school every morning and my rhythm got stopped. I haven't been able to resume that routine quite so perfectly again, but can at least say I meditate most days before work. It's so easy to find excuses to let meditation slide, and I often do. The thing that makes me reinstate the ritual is remembering the big picture of what I really want from life. Do I want to get through a never-ending to-do list, or do I want to live more mindfully? Do I want to give in to endless rushing, or do I want to cultivate qualities such as calmness, peace, and presence? Do I want to tirelessly pursue the approval of my colleagues, who really aren't particularly obsessed with what I'm doing? Or do I want to pursue what in my heart I know matters so much more, that is, taking refuge in Buddhist teachings rather than in worldly glory and gain? A wise Buddhist friend of mine, who works as an oncologist, once said, "I look back on my day and ask not how much did I get done, but how present was I?" After all, assessing a day purely on how much we get done suggests we're living on automatic pilot and driven by habit energy. And as we all know, there's a better way to live. Perhaps most importantly, my practice is very much about self-compassion, so that if I'm going through something difficult at home or at work, I'm less likely to beat myself up, or give myself a hard time. I just identify the moment as a moment of dukkha, remind myself that this is a universal experience that everyone experiences, and then offer myself kindness and understanding. I try to bathe or immerse myself in this feeling of kindness for a few moments, in meditation or as part of a pause in daily activities. So in conclusion, we might come along to conferences like this and put all the speakers up on a pedestal and think, why can't I be more like them? They seem so together, so joyous, so wise. Isn't there anyone out there as messed up as I am? So I'm here to tell you, yes, there is. But the only way to deal with our neuroticism is with curiosity, attention, and most importantly, not guilt and shame, but with self-compassion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for that very open and honest sharing. I think many people do suffer from this complex of, oh gee, I shouldn't be losing my temper because I'm a Buddhist. And that is hard going. So now we move on to the third speaker, Venerable Miao Yu, who is a disciple of the world-renowned Dharma Master, Venerable Master Xingyan. She was in the corporate sector before transforming her life into nunhood. And she's now the director of the Nantian Institute, which is Australia's first institute of higher learning offering postgraduate degrees grounded in Buddhist wisdom and values. She was also a member of the training committee of Australian Association of Buddhist Counselors and Psychotherapists. She's also a guest lecturer on the Buddhist Ethics for Sydney Business School panel for the executive MBA program. So welcome, Venerable Miao Yu.
Thank you, Venerables, Honorable Sangha, and ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor to be here, and I'd like to thank Ajahn Brahm and the organizing committee for inviting me here, to allow me to share my story. So I don't know if my story was any inspiration to you, but I hope it does, and there is always hope. So,
how do I work it?
Can I go to the slide?
Do I work it myself or?
Oh, okay. So, do I work it? Right. Life is complicated. Well, I didn't have another word for it at that time. Now I know life is suffering. But then I would say that my life is not simple. It's very complicated because I don't know what's wrong with my life or what's wrong with me. And I felt I had the need to control everything. I would call myself a control freak, and I'm a perfectionist. I want everything to be right. And I don't take criticism very easily. So I find myself very lonely in the world. And when things doesn't work out right, of course, it's somebody else's fault. And I'm angry. I'm upset. And as you can see, if I continue this way, who wants to get close to me? So relationships was always a problem. And I just have lots of conflicts which I can't deal with. And I don't know what you call it. So I'm always blaming other people. Next one. So seeing others' perspective was not possible. Because how could I see? I'm so self-centered. I am the center of the universe, and normally, if I say one, no one says two. If I say white, nobody will say black. So I have no shades of grays. It's either black or white, and there's nothing in between. So this is the sort of person I am. And we said there was a song, I think by Elton John, was it? Sorry is another word? I don't think so. Sorry was a difficult word, and even though I know of that word, it's in my vocabulary, but I don't say it often. So that was the person I am, and I have a lack of understanding of myself. So how can there be peace? How can there be harmony when I am within myself so much conflicts about what I want and what I can do, and what I can't achieve. So there is no word for me about low self-esteem. I didn't know anything about psychology at all. What about knowing about myself? I have no idea. So, of course, now I know that I have very low self-esteem, and what I was seeking for is actually security. So how else do you find security? By possessions. So I have lots of possessions. I have everything that money can buy. But was I happy? No. So I find myself sort of angry all the time, because that was my best defense mechanism. So if I was angry, people don't come close to me. And I actually don't want people to come close to me. But I was also in a bit of a conflict, because I do want people close to me. So you see, this is the sort of very neurosis mind that I had. So I really don't know what I want. So I'm hurting inside. But I think nobody cares. And I don't have the avenue or to seek help. Because when I was growing up, you don't seek help, right? You have to figure out everything yourself. So, and I grew up being independent, but I was building walls around me. So there was barriers. So you can't reach me, but I need to reach out, but I can't reach out either. So I really lack self-understanding, self-knowledge. And worst of all, because of my expectation of myself, that I need to perform, I need to be perfect, I actually impose those expectations on others. And as you can see, so I make a lot of enemies. In the office, I was called the Dragon Lady. And you can see I was very lonely. Nobody liked me. So who would like the Dragon Lady? And that was who I was. So it didn't work out for me at all. Yeah. So as we said, you know, an unenlightened mind has lots of attachments. And I didn't know I was really very sick. With all this imposition that I had on myself, I actually developed chronic fatigue syndrome. So what was that? I was very tired. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I was burned out, actually. So one day, when my mind's always working at a great speed, but my body was very slow. So one morning when I was driving to work, you know, I'm a workaholic. So that was my escape. So I don't have to think about myself. And I was driving to work one day. And the car, I didn't see the red light or something. So I stepped on the brakes and the steering locked. And the car skidded on Pacific Highway. It made a 360 degrees turn on the other side of the road. Lucky, it was 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning. There were no cars. So that really, really shocked me. So I drove to work, still shaking from that incident. And that sort of, it's a wake-up call for me to say, hey, you need to look at yourself. So for me, my body is my body, my mind is my mind. They never come together, actually. So most of those mornings I get to work, I was amazed I was there, but I don't know how I got there. So this was how a tragic, you would say, I was. I was really, my body and mind didn't work together. So not understanding that your body should be one with your mind. So how do I treat this chronic fatigue syndrome? I just rested. And I actually slept for 2 weeks. So I slept and slept and slept. After 2 weeks, this was really a wake-up call for me, because I thought to myself, if I don't change my mind, my life, I will die. So I actually went to see a psychologist. And what I know today is that the psychologist actually introduced me to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, like what the Dr. Tian said. So suddenly, for the first time in my life, I was able to observe what my mind was doing. So it's the mind watching the mind. And I know the difference between thinking and feeling. And so for the first time then, I had the courage to feel and to look at my life. And because in the past, I was never true to my own feelings. I was never true to my needs or wants. So because that probably was the way that we were brought up. So you put other people's needs first, but you will not be able and not allow other people to stop you from doing what you want to do. So it becomes very selfish. And the fact that I couldn't be myself, I think, was why I was so angry. So I always used to compartmentalize my life and compartmentalize and segregate my roles. So at the end of it all, I lost who I am, or who I found myself through a journey of, you could say, psychoanalysis or psychotherapy for about a year. So I was in therapy for a while and learning a lot about myself. And I come across this quote. I think this must be stolen from Thich Nhat Hanh, and in one of his books that I read now, it's called Transformation at the Base. And he says, mind is like a field in which every kind of seed is sown, and the quality of our life depends on the quality of our seeds that lies deep in our consciousness. And so I said that, you know, we can decide what kind of seeds we want to nurture. So if we nurture the good seeds, and then the good seeds will sprout. If we nurture the negative seeds will sprout more because they are more up on our consciousness. They're more prevalent. And so thanks to MBCT, this awareness had me thinking that I need to nurture my good seeds, and always when I have a negative thought, I will transform and replace them with positive ones. And we know where habits come from. Repeated actions give us the habits, and habits dictate character. So because I was in the habit of getting angry all the time, and that becomes, and I become an angry person. And so what is the destiny? The destiny is that I'm living in hell on earth. So the healing begins when I was introduced to the Dharma. And I wanted to share this Dharma with you. It is called the 8 Realizations of the Great Beings. It's a Mahayana teachings, and there are 8 areas that show us 8 aspects of our lives that we can learn and nurture. It nurtures us. It gives us a real understanding about this world and this phenomena and how our thoughts is really the problem. So here we said the world is impermanent and all those things that you have read. The mind is the source of our problems, desires, and greed and ignorance are those 3 poisons that lead us to unwholesome thoughts and mental factors. And what we need to practice and develop is develop understanding of the Dharma and the world, and live simply and make vows to help others. So one more, the last one. Okay. And that's when I was introduced to humanistic Buddhism. I joined the Fu Quan Shan order, and the first time I actually went into the temple, I have this sense of belonging, that I am home. So all these years that I was been searching back to somewhere to belong, I suppose, and I haven't found it. But when I arrived at the temple, I have this great sense that this is where I belong. I know where I'm at now. And so after 2 years
when they observe me as a layperson, I suppose, then I join the order. So the practice of humanistic Buddhism helps me. And to have an open mind, to be accepting of all the conditions, and to be grateful, no blaming, and forgiveness. And so this is my journey. Next one. So I hope that you all can have a very interesting journey of self-knowledge and transformation as well. I have one quote by Master Xin Yun, and he said, "A person who does not know one's nature is really sad. After practicing Chan, which is meditation, life will be different. And after enlightenment, one will see things as they really are. Because after all is one and one is all. So we're here to share and to support one another in our growth." So thank you very much for allowing me to share.
Thank you very much, Venerable Miao Yi. Another amazing open sharing. And I hope it's inspiring you as well as it is to me, listening to, from someone who's been in the corporate world, being a dragon lady, and now becoming a beautiful phoenix. So there's hope, right? Okay, and now we have another very special speaker who was born and raised in Uganda, Africa. And he first encountered Buddhism in 1990 while in India, and he started practicing meditation in 1993. And he joined the monastics in 2002, and where he received higher ordination by the late Venerable Sivananda at the Theragata Meditation Center in California. So he has been continuing to practice under the guidance of Bhante Gunaratana for about 8 years. And he also then started authoring books, one of which is The Planting Dhamma Seeds, The Emergence of Buddhism in Africa. So besides spending time at the Buddhist Center in Uganda, he's been teaching meditation in Brazil, Europe, Australia, Asia, and the United States. So now let's hear the interesting account of his life story, Venerable Buddharakita.
I must say I have a good karma to be born in Africa, so I'm not afraid to be in Africa. So I trust you're invited to me. I challenge Ajahn Brahm. I've met him in his Thailand, Sri Lanka, Germany, I don't know, everywhere. But I challenge him to come to Africa. He will have a lot of fun. And all of you here, I hope the tenth global conference of Buddhism will be in Uganda. So that everybody who has a fear of Africa will overcome the fear. So I'd like to express my gratitude to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia for inviting me here for the first time, actually, in Perth. I've been to Australia this year, actually, for the fourth time, but not to Perth. I've been to Sydney, I've been to Melbourne. So thank you very much to bring me to Perth. And I hope I'll come again. I would like to talk about how actually I become a Buddhist, and the topic is self-discovery, following the Buddha's path. That's what I want to present to you today. And when I was asked to give a talk about my path, I said, what has this to do, with resolving conflict with mindfulness? So what? But when I reflected, I found out actually it's through conflict that I came to the path. And in the larger picture, I think that the Buddha was having a lot of conflict with the Brahmins and all this. He said, no way, there must be a middle path. So I think my path to Buddhism is punctuated with lots of conflicts, and it's not enough to address them in 15 minutes, but I'll try. Born as a Roman Catholic in Uganda to Christian parents, I grew up in Uganda. I had education up to A-levels. And I was growing up, my mother was very wise. My mother told me, if you have nothing to do, keep quiet. I mean, if you have nothing to say, keep quiet. And if you have nothing to do, sleep. So I had lots of sleep. Even I had sleeping competition when I was St. Andrew's College, Chitovo. I used to be the best sleeper. Now, what's very interesting is I ordained my mother and took 10 precepts in the Burmese tradition. And I told her, if you have nothing to say, keep quiet. If you have nothing to do, meditate. So, actually, my mother had a big impact on my life. And even recently, when I was in Uganda, I told her that, you know, you told me to sleep all the time. I said, yes, yes. And I told her that human rights, you're against human rights. And then she said, oh, you know, I did it purposely. I didn't want to associate with naughty boys and girls. And then she told me actually that she slept in a doorway and took a nap in a doorway. And because in Ugandan African culture, you cannot jump your parents. So, she slept on the doorway so I couldn't jump her. And I had to be inside all the time in the house. But actually, my mother enjoyed sleeping, especially after lunch, take a nap. And she told me, you know, sleep on the side of the wall. And she slept on a bed just near the edge for the same reason that I won't jump her. And then for her, she slept. And for me, I just kept on tossing around. And I sat down and I just looked. Just look. For her sleeping, and me, I sit. I start observing what's going on with my mind until almost 1 hour. And then she woke up, and then that's it. So I didn't meditate, but actually I watched a lot what was going in my mind. So I think my mother introduced me to Buddhism, actually. To be at peace with myself, to be at peace with silence. Because when I was living in the United States, silence is a punishment. The little boy did something, so go to your room, keep quiet, don't come. So that's the first time to learn that silence is punishment. For me, it was silence and observing my thoughts and looking at my mother. It was a wonderful way, actually, of introducing me to silence. And when I was a teenager, actually, when I was at the university, after lunch, I just stayed in my bed and keep quiet and be silent. And I would see other boys walking around, knocking on my door, who wanted to fill the gaps, actually. That means they were not comfortable with themselves. So they wanted to fill the gap, the vacuum, by just coming up with talks. Some of them were useless. Anyway, this is how I came to Buddhism. Born as a Roman Catholic, eventually becoming a Baha'i official in India, because I left Uganda for India for an exchange program. So I became officially Baha'i from Christianity. I even actually one time, I think 1 month, I became born again. And then after that, I was initiated into Hinduism by Kalkaji in New Delhi. Later on, I said, this is not enough. You see conflict where I'm going? Okay, then I say, yes, I must set Tibetan teacher actually. So I went to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And actually there was no accommodation. I slept on the floor. But anyway, I knew that I'm going to see him. And the first time I saw him, he shake my hand all the time like this. And all the Westerners were saying, what were you talking with His Holiness the Dalai Lama? Because we kept on shaking hand like this for a long time. Later on, he became one of my best friends, actually. I met him many times, and I had a private audience. And I remember when I had a private audience with him, he was just waiting outside there after seeing a journalist. And then we all hold each other hand like this and went to his room in India, and we had a chat, a talk. And I told him, please bless me. I would like to introduce Buddhism in Uganda and entire Africa. He said, do you have friends? I said, no. Find good friends. So I want to structure this talk in a Buddhist context, in a way so that at least you get a feel of what Buddhists are about. The Buddha talks about the four wheels of success in Anguttara Nikaya. He talks about the 38 blessings, and four of them is associating with a wise person. The second one is living in a suitable place. Another one is actually having done good things in the past, merit. Another one is actually setting oneself in the right path. So as you can see, as I embarked on my path, is through association with the wise, starting with my mother. She didn't know Buddhism, but she had natural wisdom. And when I went to India in 1990 on a government exchange program between Uganda and India, and I went at the university there to study business, Bachelor of Commerce, business. Can you imagine? Actually, I don't want to be a businessman. But because the family I was growing up in Uganda, they had a company, business people. So they told me you should become a business person. So then I was interested. So the parents also influenced me. So anyway, I went to study business, and I didn't complete my degree because when I met the monks, they took me to the monastery in India, and they told me about Buddhism, and I was very interested in Buddhism. And then, in fact, when I met them, I was so inspired with their behavior, the way they talk. One thing I wasn't inspired by what they were doing is they didn't eat dinner. And in Africa, you don't do dinner, you're in a problem. This is our best meal of the day, actually. I thought I'll never become even a monk, actually. So anyway, they took me to the monastery, and I was inspired with their life. And as I told you, I met the Dalai Lama, was an inspiration. And living in a suitable place like India, there's a lot of spiritual tradition there. So it gave me a chance to explore. When I was in Uganda, I wasn't given that chance, especially studying in a boarding school. I was in a boarding school. Then every day you have to go to the chapel, repeating the same thing, very boring. And actually, one time I had to hide myself in a bed so that I don't go to the chapel because I was bored. So when I did my first meditation in Toshita, it was a 12 days retreat taught by Dr. Alex Bazin. It was amazing. It was science, and it was exploring your mind to get rid of all those conflicting ideas. I was so inspired by meditation. So that 12 days changed my life forever. Watching the intentions and all that. I must tell you, the food was also great, actually, during that retreat at Toshita in Makroganj, Dharamsala. So living, of course, in a suitable place like India was a nurturing place for me to explore the practices of Buddhism. And actually, later on, I went to Thailand. Actually, I escaped India. They nearly deported me because I was staying with weird people, Buddhists. So actually, my aunt was working in India at the Uganda embassy. And she was arranging a deportation. I said, no, let me escape to Nepal. So I went to Nepal, went to Tibet, and of course, I was inspired by Tibet. I thought, if I'm to be reborn again, I would like to be reborn in Tibet. It was a wonderful place for me, meeting all the lamas. They didn't know English, but they were speaking the language of the heart, which touched me so much. So after that, of course, I decided to go back to Uganda, to Thailand, became a scuba diver, instructor for 2 years, and I left. I quit because I wanted to go to meditate. So I went back to Africa. Everybody wanted to convert me into Christianity. I said, that's crazy. It's too late. My dear, it's too late. I had a shaved head. I got malaria, and they told me because I don't believe in Jesus, that's why I have malaria. I said, no, it's not true. So I left. Went to South America. Ended up in the United States, and I meditated for 3 months. And that's when that really blew my mind. 3 months meditation, looking at your mind, my mind, it was amazing. So that's where I met, actually, Bante Gunaratana, who came in 2000 to teach there and invited me to come to Bhavana Society, but I was not yet ordained. So I went actually after my service, volunteer service at IMS in Barre, Massachusetts. I went to California and I was ordained by Sadhu Usilananda. And later on, actually, I returned to Bhavana Society in West Virginia and I stayed with Bante Gunaratana for 8 years. So after 8 years, even before that, I decided to go back to Uganda to establish the first and the only temple in Uganda. My mother is a nun there taking care of the place, and I'm recruiting monks, actually. I'm sending one Ugandan to Thailand at Wat Panana Chato then, and there's another monk I'm taking from Rwanda to Sri Lanka to then. And once we have 5 monks, we all go back to Africa and start the work properly. Because after 10 years, I say, no, this is not the work I can do alone. As His Holiness the Dharma told me, you need to have friends. So, my friends, please come and join me. I all welcome you to to come to Uganda and spread the Dharma. Please join hands. And I want to tell you that according to the Buddha's teaching, we talk about also having done meritorious deed, of course, also establishing oneself in the right path. So I established myself in the right path, because before I was wondering, what's the right path? So I started meditating, so that was wonderful for me. So my friend, I want to end up with a question. What has this all Buddhist path helped me to see my African upbringing and Christian upbringing? So, and also, what can I contribute to African? It's a huge continent. So my friend, I found out something actually in Buddhism that can help me to establish Buddhism in Africa. So I am actually using African proverbs, which is impregnated with wisdom, and comparing it with Buddhist teaching. One of them I would like to share with you before I end is the love karma. Is actually part of Ugandan wisdom. The Ugandan love karma goes like this. What you do comes back to you. When you actually when you eat a maggot in a mushroom, it will eat you in a grave. So you can see that's a love karma. In fact, this is very interesting. According to our proverb in Uganda, is that when you eat a maggot in a mushroom, you don't know that. But still, it will eat you. So you can see the same principles in Buddhism, the love karma. So my friends, this is what I reflect on, how I can contribute to African wisdom. And I think I'm going to give a talk tomorrow about this at the Buddhinyana Monastery. Thank you very much for listening to my path, self-discovery, and my next path is non-self-discovery. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Venerable Buddha Rakita, for being so inspiring, bringing Buddhism to Africa. And I think it's a delightful thing, and we all wish you all the best, and perhaps you could be the Ajahn Brahm of Africa. And now we have our last speaker for this session. Venerable Hasapana is no stranger to many of us who visit or live in Western Australia. She is the abbot of the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery and the assistant spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. She's very much involved in teaching and training the nuns and anagarikas and many lay people and taking them on the path. In 2009, she was ordained as a bhikkhuni by Arya Tathaloka. Many of you think or thought it was Ajahn Brahm. Actually, he was only the observer And even then he got expelled. So, so the real preceptor was Arya Tathaloka. So with that, join me to welcome our Venerable Hasapana. So I think some of the monks will be leaving for their lunch. They're not walking out on Venerable Hasapana.
Okay. So yes, I'm one of the four nuns that causes Ajahn Brahms a lot of problem. And also he's got expelled. But good, bad, who knows? So Ajahn Brahms, now you're free. You can start a new tradition in Western Australia. So, yeah, actually, I didn't prepare anything. I really don't know what I'm going to say. And I just, yeah, maybe just introduce a little bit about Dhammasara. So, yes, Dhammasara city are located in Gijigenap. So it's it's about 600 acres, 583 acres. So at the moment, we bought the Buddhist Society bought this land in 1998, and we have 6 bhikkhunis, 3 seminaries, and 1 anagarikas residing in our monastery, Dhammasara Monastery, and we have. At the moment, so 10 of us, and we have one long-term lay woman staying with us. So we have only one cottage. There's 3 rooms. So one room is for the office. You know, we do our stuff there, and 2 rooms for lay visitors. And we have two caravans and 8 kutis. So it's all occupied. So due to the expansion of our business, so we need to build more facilities. So we built at the moment, we are building 1 big Dharma hall, 1 dining hall, and amenities block, and another 15 rooms for lay women to come to train to become a nun, and also for lay women that would like to have a taste of monastic life. So there's a lot of opportunities for whoever would like to become a nun. So you're all welcome. So maybe I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Venerable Hasapana. So you don't have to go to Nantian. If you're a dragon lady, you can go to Dhammasara and be a nun as well. And so now we'd like to open to the floor for any questions or any comments that you may have that you'd like to share. We certainly welcome.
I'd like to give a commercial, actually.
A commercial? Okay.
Yes.
You got 2 minutes for commercial.
Oh, 1 minute.
Okay, 1 minute.
Tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., we have Venerable Buddha Rakhita giving a talk. It's a public talk, free. And please do come. It is in a unique place, Bodhinyana Monastery, the Dhamma Hall in the Bodhinyana Monastery. We'll be filming it for a specific purpose. And it will be on the topic of how African wisdom, the traditional wisdom of Africa, relates to the teachings of Buddhism. So please come and show your support. Thank you.
What time again?
6:30 p.m. after work.
Okay,
come
great.
Over at
okay.
Bodhinyana Monastery.
Okay, great.
And
those of you don't know where that is.
For about 45 minutes. Or
it's in Serpentine, and you can look it up on the Google map.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you have a question there, ma'am?
Yes, I do.
Please go ahead.
I'm Nam Pet from Thailand. I think we've been partnered in crimes in terms of opening up Uganda with the donation of the mosquito tent from Thailand as the first backyard, I believe, temple. And my question to Venerable Buddharakita is, you're now opening Rwanda after Uganda. Am I correct? And in terms of your wish list, would there be any training for women monastics in Africa?
Yes. Thank you very much, Yom Namped, for asking this question. Actually, I used your tent that you donated. I used your tent that you donated to me to start the first mobile temple. I have that concept in Uganda. It's called mobile temple. It's cheap to start a temple. So that's the person who donated.
It's a Thai African collaborative for the womb movement, if you recall us naming it.
Yes, your tent is still there even after 10 years. You can come and have a look at the tent that I used to start the first Buddhist temple in Uganda. So definitely I'm heading to Rwanda. I have a guy from Rwanda staying at our temple who is going to become a monastic. So to answer your question, yes, emphatically yes, because my mother is already a Buddhist nun. So I don't see why they should not be Buddhist.
Thank you.
And actually recently there is the Thai ambassador to Kenya came to Uganda, and I wasn't there, and I just met my mother, and he was so impressed to see the mother of the monk and donated even $200. And I think that when people come to our temple, even when I'm not there, my mother as a nun actually inspired many people. By the way, I tell you one thing. One time I was in USA and went back to Uganda, and three boys wanted to become Buddhist. I asked here, no, I'm not going to make you a Buddhist before you tell me why you want to become a Buddhist. So these three boys told me that we are becoming Buddhist because of your mother. I said, what is my mother teaching you? She doesn't know much English. She doesn't know much discourses. They told me your mother doesn't teach anything by talking, by through actions. She always practices generosity. Whenever there's a death, she's the first person to give food. So if I can be here and the Dharma is spreading in Africa through my mother, I don't see why I don't do it in Rwanda and the whole of Africa. Yes, I support. There will be nuns there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, thank you.
Yes, can we have the next question?
Hello. Hi, I'm Ing Han from Singapore. I think when I first came to Australia and to do a retreat, I was actually very happy that to hear about the nuns' past. I think in 2012 when I was doing a retreat and heard a lot about how the nuns, you know, the different paths that actually have to practice. So me and my wife at that point in time were very impressed and very touched. And that's why we actually made a trip down to Dhammasara to actually really visit the place before we actually went back to Singapore. So my wife, unfortunately, is back in Singapore right now and unable to be at this conference. But I would just like to find out more about how has the Dhammasara like developed since like 2012, and so that I could actually tell her about how it has grown. Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, we have a short 2.5 minutes video clips that show how the progress and the building site. And is it Jade? You ready?
Sugata sasavaka ete sudimak kanti.
So there's been quite a lot of development in the last year. But the important thing to understand is that the most important development that's happening is the fact that we're even here.
Tina tena samona vichati ida pigame ratana kanitang ekena sachena suwa tiho tuye pugala atasatang pasata chatavi etani yugani ho tise takimeya sugata.
Situated in is already up, so you can actually visit it when you next go to Dhammasara Monastery. When I visited 2 days ago, I was told that the Dhammasara Monastery also has a fish and chips store. Not really. It's called Fish and Chip Shop, but it's actually the library. Ajahn Brahm named it the Fish and Chip Shop. So go find out where it is when you next visit. Yes, thank you. For the next question.
Morning, everyone. My name's Lisa. I'm a clinical psych and a mum. And I first wanted to say thank you for having the conference in Perth. It's been fantastic, and I'm very grateful that it's been in Perth this time. So thank you to everyone involved. And thank you, everyone, for your lovely talks this morning. Just a general comment for you, Sarah. I've got all your books, and I chose to stay at home when I had my babies, and your books help me a lot, keep my sanity at times, but I pass on your wisdom to a lot of other people too. So thanks very much for your books. Thank you.
Thank you. So are you all hungry? Perhaps that's why there are no more questions. If not, I think what we will do is take this time to really thank all the people that have really contributed to this conference. So can we give them a round of applause? So thank you to the wonderful speakers for their very open, honest, heartwarming sharing, which I think has been amazingly inspirational. Thank you very much.